For 1 week and 1 week only, men are invited onto Radio Gorgeous. Welcome to Man Week. Welcome to Man Week on Radio Gorgeous. For 1 week a year, we allow men on, and today I'm very happy to be talking to Alexander Larman. He's an author of books, Blazing Star and Restoration, The Year of a Great Fire. He also writes for Telegraph, The New Statesman, and The Times Literary Supplement and The Observer. But today, we are talking about his latest book, Byron's Women. Hi, Alexander. Welcome to Man Week on Radio Gorgeous.
Hello.
So, Byron, we all know who he is, poet, writer, romantic and revolutionary, who is mad, bad and dangerous to know. Why have you written a book about the women?
My first book was about Lord Rochester, who was a libertine poet, general man about town. And it was a fascinating book to research and to write. And I thought after that, I want to write about Byron. But Byron has been such a well-worn subject that I thought a more interesting way into his life was to look at the people around him. Because when we think about Byron, we think about his love affairs, we think about his daughter Ada Lovelace, and we think about these really significant people. So I thought a much more interesting biographical slant would be to start with his mother, end with his daughters, and bring in the various women in his life as well.
He was wildly decadent, wasn't he? And he, the greatest love affair he actually had, and I think the greatest respect he had for a woman in his life, was his sister. Mm-hmm. Can you tell us about that?
Absolutely. Well, Augusta Leigh was his half-sister by his father, who was this dissolute man known as Jack Byron. And she disappeared from his life when he was young, but she came back when he was older, and they began a love affair.
And how old were they?
He would have been in his early 20s. She would have been in her mid-20s.
So she was older than him?
Yes,
she's a couple
of years older.
Wow. Now, what did he see in her? Was it himself? I mean, did he have that bigger ego? Or she seemed like a sweet person, actually.
Yes, I mean, she's a person I probably liked most when I was doing research for the book, actually, because she's very likable. I mean, she was... The odd thing is, you're writing about people 200 years ago, and yet you pick up on characteristics that make them seem entirely contemporary. The fact that she was known as Goose, because when she got excited, she started to stutter, and it made her sound a bit like a cackling goose. But of course, the name also came from the fact her nickname was Gus. And details like that really bring somebody to life, don't they?
Yeah, it means that she's a real person. She's got a lot of character.
Yeah. And I think what it was, Byron was, he was an egomaniac and a narcissist of the absolute first order. I suppose the idea of having an affair with your own sister, something other people just didn't do, was something that really appealed to him. Because all his life, he tried to shock people. He tried to look at, you know, what society was and how to go against it. And I suppose that's one of the reasons why an affair with her was so decadent and so beyond the pale.
I want to compare Byron to someone now. I was thinking probably Mick Jagger. Who do you think? Or Johnny Depp? You know.
Johnny Depp's a bit failed, I think. Yeah. Yeah, Jack is a better one. I mean, especially when he was young. I mean, he modelled himself on Byron. He dressed like Byron. He would quote Byron aphorisms in interviews. Because the thing about Byron, and writing the book was very important for me, was to get... And the same thing, actually, with Rochester and Blazing Star. There's a lot of myths. I wanted to tackle these. He treated women appallingly. He wasn't a great romantic. He wasn't a great lover of women. He hated women. He used women. And he was somebody who had a contempt for female sex.
Do you think that was a typical kind of public school attitude of men that time?
I think it was very much an attitude of the aristocrats. I think it was somebody who... He was a child, effectively. He was brilliant, but he was a spoilt child. And if he didn't get his way, temper, petulance, anger... And so you look at the women in the book who he had affairs with, and certainly his last affair with Teresa Cicely, you see a tiredness there, you see a resignation.
Yeah, he even became a bit domesticated, didn't he?
Yeah. And that's very strange, because the idea of Byron tamed is an odd one. Mm-hmm. But obviously, you know, we look at, say, Caroline Lamb. Mm.
And now Caroline Lamb was the one that said the expression mad, bad and dangerous to know, and she was a cross-dresser. I just want to point that out. And I think she sounded really interesting.
She's fascinating. Mm. And actually she's one of those people that you become excited and you want to write a book about from purely because her literary career, which I devote a few pages to, but could make up a book on its own.
Yeah. Started. So she was obviously talented.
Yeah. Oh, she's a very bright woman. But because, of course, she was a woman, she was kept down by her society. Mm. And over again, writing a book, you see people, Mary Shelley and her mother, Mary Wollstonecraft.
Who was one of the first feminists.
Yes. Yeah. Well, they were considered mad. I mean, they were literally considered insane for wanting to espouse these feminist and... very much ahead of her time ideas. And it's just insane to think that, you know, 200 years ago, women could be regarded so poorly. Yet set against that, a lot of the characters of the book, they're independent, they travel through Europe unchaperoned, they sit down and discuss ideas which were thought to be revolutionary hundreds of years later.
Now, that's one of the keys. It seems like leaving England gave people a freedom, didn't it?
Yes, I mean, I think that the key was not to live in another country as a servant, or not as a servant, as a subject of that country, but to be in another country and have a freedom that offered you. With Byron, it was Greece, and later, of course, it was fighting the Turks. But it was also Italy, it was also Switzerland.
But he had to leave, didn't he?
Well, the circumstances of Byron's leaving England, I compare them to Oscar Wilde 80 years later. Wilde was offered the chance to leave England, he didn't take it, he's prosecuted. If Byron hadn't left England, he probably would have been prosecuted.
And what would he have been prosecuted for?
Sodomy.
Okay, so because that was his other thing. He liked young boys, didn't he? He didn't have affairs with... He liked pretty boys,
He had affairs with anyone. He was a man of legendary appetites. Boys, girls, young boys, young girls. I mean, you could call him a paedophile if you wanted. I mean, there was...
Yeah, but that's what I don't want to do, because I think that's exactly what we want to do nowadays, label them, isn't it? Because why should we? Because they were in a different time. So in a way, if we respect them for what they are, you know, and I think, you know, and he was getting away with it. He was also living life to the bloody full. I mean, you know, he had a carnal appetite.
Yeah.
A lot of people would think, good on him.
What I think makes him so distinctive is the fact that we have these 12 volumes of his letters, and he was one of the great letter writers ever. And his voice comes through so strongly. And as I write in the introduction to the book, I started off liking Byron, then I came to hate him. By the end, I found myself half seduced by him. And I think I'll always have a very ambivalent attitude towards him because the wit, the intelligence, I mean, the brilliance of the poetry will always endure.
I mean, do you think he was a genius?
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I mean, I think he's by far the greatest of your romantic poets. I think he has a lot more to say. But I think that today he speaks much more clearly to us than any of the others because, you see, you've got Wordsworth being windy about nature, but you've got Byron talking about power, about the abuses of power, the unfairness of society. I mean, he was a man of great political interest. He was very much somebody who stood for the working man.
Yes, he was left-wing.
Yeah,
good.
But, I mean, he was left-wing in an intelligent and nuanced way, not in a knee-jerk way, because obviously somebody of his background, there's always the worry that they're just going to be saying these things to court popularity. But he was a genuine thinker.
Yeah, I'd also like to know, I mean, I found that Claire, the girl, she was actually a groupie, wasn't she?
Yeah.
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 Yeah, because she wrote to him, she wanted to see him, she followed him. Mm-hmm. She kind of pushed herself onto him, and he thought, well, I might as well.
Well, in one of his letters, he says, well, if a girl's going to travel thousands of miles across the Alps to philosophise me, what else could I do? And it's true, but, I mean, the book is, in a sense, her tragedy, because it's the central act of the book, his betrayal of her and then stealing their daughter.
Yes, this was the most heart-rending thing in the book. that she's friends with Mary Shelley, and they have this kind of mad idea that actually Byron would be better to look after the child than she would. I mean, can you imagine giving up your child to someone who didn't give a damn? But why did she hand over? Why would you hand over something you loved so much?
I'm afraid the answer is noblesse oblige. Byron was an English lord. It was therefore thought that he was in a better position to look after a young child.
What, money and rank, then?
Well, he didn't have much money early in his life, but later in his life he did, because after the various deaths of people around him. For instance, his complex marriage settlement to Annabella Milbank meant that even after... They never got divorced, they only separated. So when her father died, he inherited a large amount of money.
God, it's disgusting. But look, I want to go back to Claire, because I want to go back to giving up the child. You just had a baby, you told me.
Yep.
Can you imagine doing this? And also, why did Byron want her?
He didn't want her. It was power. And it's the point of a book, writing it. I began to think, I don't want to write this anymore, because it's something really horrible and really nasty, because you see Byron at his absolute worst, a man who... He hated Claire. He hated everything about her. Taking the child from her was a petty way of exerting his own authority over her. And then he didn't care about the child because it got in the way of his having affairs. So he dumped her in a convent, went off, didn't see much of the child, and the child died of, I think, typhoid. And it's... You see all that, and you see the horrible, predictable way it's all going to pan out. And it's just very hard and very difficult because it's a tragedy. And it's something that I didn't know much about it before I came to write the book. I mean, I knew he'd had a daughter, well, two daughters, two and a half daughters.
Yeah, and whenever he had daughters, he went, oh, it's just a daughter.
Yeah.
I noticed that. Yeah,
yeah, he wanted a son, never had one.
Yeah.
The only thing is that something I tried a long time to find was whether there were any more children of Byron, because early in the book I found that he got one of the servants pregnant in Newstead Abbey, and I thought, is there no record of where the child went, no record of whether there was a miniature Byron boy?
Well, maybe he's a rock star now.
Maybe he's Mick Jagger.
Now, I want to talk about Byron's looks.
Yep.
And also his limp,
yeah.
You know, because he was obviously disabled. But
yeah.
what was he gorgeous?
Yes. Mm. I mean, if you look at the portraits of him, he's stunning. And they're consistent enough for you to be able to really realise what he looked like.
So he's tall, dark, mm-hmm. high cheekbones,
yep.
big lips,
yep.
big eyes.
Yeah. That's a cascading black curly hair.
Yeah, yeah.
Harry Styles, actually, is quite a good comparison.
Yeah, yeah. But no. Oh, maybe the guy in Poldark. You know.
Aidan Turner,
Harry Styles is a bit weedier. You know, I imagine Byron to have been bigger, but we don't know, do we?
The funny thing is, you say bigger, he was fat.
Oh.
That's the other thing about Byron that you have to remember, that he spent his life oscillating between being very slim and very fat.
Sounds like a lot of men I know. Especially ones that like a bon vivant, which he was.
Yes, but he had all these crazy diets, for instance.
It's so modern.
He would have diets purely consisting of salt water.
Oh, Christ.
The idea is that it would make him throw up. That's all he drank.
It's a brilliant diet. Remember that one.
but by the end of his life, he was tired.
Yeah, he was a bit of a wreck. I think that's why he gave in. But then he felt bad giving in, so he thought, I've got to go and find a revolution. And he wanted South America or Greece.
Yeah.
And Greece was a bit nearer.
I mean, my take on it, and I think I say this more or less explicitly in the book, is he had no real interest in Greek independence. It was just a big show. It was something he did because he was bored. And I think that he had these absurd ideas he was going to go out there and achieve something glorious. In fact, he died in his bed. So it was all a bit pathetic, really.
Yeah, but then isn't life... There are, you know, it is tragic life. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You know, it's hard to... How can you keep on being brilliant, you know? I mean, he did pretty well for someone who... There wasn't the internet, there wasn't photographers, there wasn't... Wherever he went, I mean, when he arrived in a town, people would come out and see him. I mean, word travelled that this man... And what was his reputation then when he was alive?
It depends if you're male or female.
Okay, tell me the female and the male view.
Men would beat their way to his door, especially literary men, to meet a great poet. That's a tradition that's endured before him and will endure afterwards. Women wanted to bed him. There's no other way of putting it. Women of all ages, all classes, wanted to have sex with Lord Byron because he was thought to be the most attractive prospect in England, men in Europe.
Wow. It's incredible.
And it's
incredible.
Hard. It's hard today to understand the level of reputation that he had, because when Childe Harold's Pilgrimage came out in 1812... He literally woke up one day and found himself famous. But then other poems of his would sell 10,000 copies on their first day of publication. People would literally stand outside a bookshop for hours before the bookshop opened to buy a poem by Byron. It was a level of fame we can't understand now. I mean, we see it with rock stars. We see it with people queuing outside, say, H&M to buy
it. That's only a part of society, isn't it? Whereas you're saying it was all society, which is different.
Because the thing is about Byron, and if I sound conflicted about him, it's because I am.
Yeah.
He was a great man, and he was a useless and awful man at the same time.
But aren't all big characters like that? I've met a lot in my life. I've read a lot about them. They're always flawed because, you know, brilliance, you've got a brilliant side, then you've got to have dark as well, you know.
Well, I hope that one day I write a book about Oscar Wilde, because I see Rochester, Byron and Wilde, and possibly later David Bowie, as characters in very much the same tradition. Rochester, I thought, was a very good man who has been maligned by history. Wilde, I think, is little short of a saint, which puts Byron at a very different remove.
Yeah, but I bet Wilde had a horrible side. I can't believe anyone... is perfect. I'm sorry, because then they couldn't. Because I don't. If you're a real goody-goody, then you're not brilliant, are you? Because you're towing the line. Brilliance is breaking the rules.
Wilde was vain. It was his vanity that brought him down.
Yeah.
But it was a vanity that I think of all flaws, it's about the least objectionable you can imagine. Okay. Yes, he betrayed his wife, I suppose. but it wasn't a betrayal in terms of, it wasn't what Byron did. It was a betrayal in terms of his inclinations and his appetites were not heterosexual.
Yeah.
But that was the case for so many
people.
But that
was his yearning. I mean, he physically, yeah. you know, yeah. if you're gay, you want to have a relationship. So he followed yeah. his body. You know?
Yeah. As with Byron, I suppose, he was, in so many respects, an amazing man. And he was a great, I mean, he was very generous. He would give huge sums of money to people. He'd literally thrust banknotes into people's hands. And it was almost pathological, the generosity. And yet he was unable, when it came to women in his life, to be anything other than cruel.
RadioGorgeous.com.
Now, we must talk about his relationship with his mother, because yes. I do say that people's emotional, a man's emotional life obviously comes from his relationship with his mother. Can you tell us about her? She was Scottish.
Yes. Catherine Gordon. She was a Scottish heiress who grew up in this haunted castle called Guyte Castle. She came down to England to see something of English society, and she went to Bath and met Byron's father, who was essentially a fortune hunter. And after he took away all her money, Byron spent the first, I think, 10 years of his life in poverty in Scotland. But then through an odd accident of fate, he inherited the title, which meant that she and he went down to Nottinghamshire to Newstead Abbey. Abbey. And she wasn't a sophisticated woman.
No.
She had a strong Scottish accent. She liked to drink. She was loud. And by the time
very ugly,
very ugly, yes.
Very ugly.
And by the time nothing like her son. Mm. By the time that her son was at Harrow, she was causing trouble. She was going down, making a fool of herself.
Socially, she didn't know how to be.
No,
yeah.
And she would, and it's an interesting and incongruous idea, isn't it? This very loud woman coming and causing trouble. And essentially, Byron was embarrassed by her. And one of his classmates once said to him, "Byron, your mother is a fool." And he said, "I know that, but you shan't say so." But on the other hand, I feel that she's been maligned by a lot of previous biographers, because a lot of people have written about her as a kind of comic grotesque. I mean, there's a story that she died after reading her son's laundry bill in a fit of rage. And what I try and do is to set out the case for Catherine Gordon, that she loved her son.
Yeah, because you also said that they really got on at one point, didn't you?
Well,
he wrote her lovely letters when he was away.
Well, he was a great letter writer, as I said, and I think one of the things he liked to do was to show off. But also there was a real affection, and you see perhaps the way their relationship would have gone had she lived.
Well, also he was brought up by a single parent mother, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Now let's talk about his dad, because his dad was absolutely terrible and absolutely brilliant. And I think that's where he gets his badness from.
Yes. Yeah. Well, I mean, his father was bad and his grandfather was bad as well. So he comes...
Long line of badness.
Yes, there were lots and lots of badens in the Byron bunch. And so, yes, I mean, when your father's called Mad Jack Byron, you're not exactly signing yourself up to a happy marriage and a happy happy childhood. But yes, I mean, you look at Mad Jack, and he was a man that utterly opportunistic, utterly, utterly ruthless, very handsome, had an affair with his sister.
Right.
So you can see, obviously, the family tradition continues. Mm. We don't really have many letters by him. I mean, we've got a few, but not nearly enough. But it's quite refreshing to come across somebody just uncomplicatedly bad. And he's a terrible, terrible man.
Because he actually only married the woman for Byron's mother for money, didn't he?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. And he was extravagant on a scale you can't even begin to imagine. I mean, he disappeared off to Paris with today's equivalent of hundreds of thousands of pounds. Spent it all in 2 months. Basically on, you know, drinking and whoring. And he just disappeared off to France. He boasted he went to Valenciennes. And he boasted that he'd had 1/3 of the town. And he died very young.
Now, I wonder if Byron was, because, you know, we all want to please our parents, whether he was, he'd heard these incredible stories about his dad, and he wanted to kind of relive these kind of fantasies he had about his father.
Well, I'm not a Freudian, but if I was a Freudian, I would have a field day speculating as to what he did in his life because of both his parents. And I feel that certainly there was a sense that his father had blazed a trail that he wanted, however consciously or subconsciously, to follow. And I think he felt that, you know, the sexual libertinism which he pursued was something that his father had done so conspicuously. I mean, there's no record of his father being homosexual or bisexual or anything like that. So we have to assume that Byron's bisexuality was something that purely came from him. Because I do believe he was bisexual. I do believe he genuinely loved boys and men.
Well, that could be your next book. Byron's Boys.
quite tempted, you know.
Now, do you think that going to Harrow, getting a really, really good education, helped with his brilliance?
No, is a simple answer to that. Because I think that we have this idea that a public school is this sort of place that you can grow up in a great intellectual stimulation. In fact, in the early 19th century, it really wasn't, because the public schools had a very large downturn, which they didn't really recover to the Victorian era. And in fact, when Byron was at Harrow, the place was rather haphazard. And it was said of him that he turned his house into a place of riot and confusion.
That sounds quite like it is now.
Well, absolutely, nothing much has changed. But you can see the idea of Byron as this charismatic ringleader figure, you know, having all of these affairs with younger boys and being very cheeky to his teachers and so on. In fact, it's very strange because his house...
Couldn't he have learned those habits there? You know, I'm wondering whether, you know, the boys, you know...
Well, one of my favourite lines of the book, actually, is there's that Petrol Boys line from It's a Sin. At school, it taught me how to be so pure in thought and word and deed, but it didn't quite succeed. I managed to get that in, actually. It was about his first tutor, who was a clergyman. And people always tried to teach Byron to be pure. They never, ever succeeded.
No.
I don't think you could have done.
So I also think what's incredible, another, I keep saying the word, a thrilling thing in the book, is Ada Lovelace. Now, she is now famous, because I've even done a podcast about her. She's famous for being the first woman that thought of first person to have the idea of a computer. But sadly, she only met Byron once.
Well, that's one way of putting it. I mean, she didn't really know him because she was so young when he left.
Yeah, explain. Also, she was the only daughter that was married in she's from a marriage. Mm-hmm. So she's going to be only legitimate daughter.
Yes.
And she's the only one that survived.
Yes. Yeah. Well, she died too young, of course.
Did she die young as well?
Relatively young. She died of cancer, I think, in her 40s.
Oh, but compared to the others.
It was a long life. But yes,
she also had a happy life.
A very happy life, a very fulfilled one, though she was horribly in debt, which was difficult.
But everybody was, because I was talking to someone yesterday about it, because imagine not having credit. I mean, nowadays, we'd all be like that. We'd all be running around and, you know, with creditors running after us, because shit happens in life, you know. But now we can kind of just go and borrow something else on our credit cards.
Well, precisely. And, of course, you have to imagine that Byron was head over heels in debt, not just to his tradesmen, who's almost de rigueur to be in debt to. He's in debt to virtually every organisation under the sun. Mm. But in terms of Ada Lovelace, I mean, she...
Yeah, tell us about her.
She was brilliant, but she's very much her father's daughter. And as her life went on, she began more and more to respect his legacy, much to her mother's horror, because her mother, Annabella, in many respects, she's the true villain of the book, because I see her as somebody she was a cold, controlling person who, after Byron's death, tried to control both Ada and Medora.
Yeah, but also he had married her for her money. Really sorry. He didn't ever love her,
no.
I don't think.
No.
So, you know, what goodness is going to come out of this? But something did, the daughter. So,
So, I mean, we have Ada Lovelace Day every October. Yeah. I'm glad we don't have a Lord Byron Day, because I don't know what would happen if that was...
Yeah, so tell us about Ada.
Well, obviously, she's this great female pioneer, because she was the first woman to basically come to terms with the concept of computers.
Yeah, I don't understand how. She thought something else could make a decision apart from humans.
So she fell in with this character called Charles Babbage, who was the inventor of something called the analytic machine, which was this very polished thing made of glass and chrome and all the rest of it, which sat in his offices in Marylebone. And she worked with Babbage on essentially developing the idea that something like this would be allowed to have independent thought, which was, of course, an incredibly ahead of its time idea.
The Industrial Revolution hadn't even happened.
No. And the idea that she, you know, she'd worked with mathematicians, but she had no formal education in this nature. But she was able to have this incredible foresight. And actually, it's one of the things... One of the great tragedies of writing a book, which I think is 130,000 words in the end, is that you want to go down all these blind alleys, but you can't. Mm. And Ada Lovelace is somebody who has not been, I think, a definitive biography of her.
Uh-huh. Look, you see, we keep finding more biographers for you. You're going to be so busy, Alexander. You really are. Well. Yeah. So tell me about you, because it is Man Week, so we're allowed to get a bit of...
And I am a man.
Yeah,
this is in fact true.
So tell me, how did you get into writing?
I wasn't any good at anything else. And so after failing at every other career that I ever pursued, I thought, right, I have to write some books now. But actually, it was that when I was at university, I read English. And of course, the great thing about having 3 years to read great writers and read about great writers is you have so much respect for the effort involved in writing a book that you begin to think, right, well, either I can do that or I can never do that. And after leaving university, I pursued a career in journalism for about 10 years, which was great fun. But the thing about journalism is that it's ephemeral, and ultimately one day's article is the next day's chip paper.
Totally agree. Yeah.
And you start to realise also there is, I think, at the moment in journalism, very much a corrupting influence.
There was no work and there's no money in journalism.
There's no money. Yeah. And also I feel that online journalism has become, everyone's obsessed by clickbait, everyone's obsessed by chasing. I mean, you put up a picture of a girl in a bikini because it's going to get more hits. That's not writing. I mean, that's entertainment. That's fine.
That's mail online.
it's mail online, but that's most read.
My son, I'm always catching reading. And my daughter. they put the app on my iPad. I'm really pissed off.
Not surprised. I'll be pissed off as well. And yes, I suppose the thing is that as a writer, you have to be much aware of both your own society and the societies you're writing about. But what I'm constantly fascinated by is how much reading and writing about Byron says about us today. Because the obsession with celebrity is still there. The dual standards, the fact that we cry out people's bad behaviour. I mean, there's that footballer who was first acquitted, then cleared of rape. And I read about all that, and I thought, it's disgusting. But who's surprised by any of this?
Yeah.
I mean, who's actually genuinely surprised that these young men with too much money are unable to behave in any...
Of course they're going to be corrupted.
Of course they are. Yeah. And you see that. You don't have to be a great writer to be corrupted by money and fame and power. And I suppose that what I feel as a writer is I want to tell stories about people who are interesting and times and places that are interesting. So that was why I wrote.
Sounds like 18th century. I mean, it is my favourite time as well. I mean, Victorian became so Victorian.
I think the Victorian period becomes much more interesting at the end, actually. I think around the 1880s and the 1890s with the Fantasy Eclat and the rise of Oscar Wilde. Mm. I think until then, it's bloody boring.
Yeah.
Because actually, there's a real... When I think about Victorian era...
Well, they were the children of Georgians, so they wanted... You know, you go the opposite of your parents.
Well, actually, you look at Victorian furniture, it's also stale.
Heavy.
And precisely. Mm. And you look at Dickens as well, and that sort of heavy, you know...
Even though I do love Dickens.
I oscillate on Dickens. I mean, Great Expectations is one of my favourite books.
Yeah.
And Tale of Two Cities, actually. I've just been rereading that. It's a really, really brilliant book. But, oh dear me, I mean, some of them like Martin Chuzzlewit, you just... You lose
the
world.
We've seen so much on telly, it's been a bit sold out to us, hasn't it?
And he can't write women. He really can't write women. You think about all the memorable Dickens characters, none of them are women.
Yeah.
And you say, oh, what about Estella?
Yeah.
Estella's a cipher. Mm. She's a vehicle for others. And, you know, you have Mrs. Gamp, you have Miss Havisham, you have these characters who are memorable, but they're all grotesques.
Yeah.
Dickens was good at writing grotesques. Mm. But yes, I mean, you look at the 19th century in terms of literature, and it's certainly a period that I think has been somewhat overrated. I think if you want great literature...
You
go to the 18th century.
Definitely.
You go to the earlier 20th century, which is, of course, you know, modernism.
Yeah.
But I feel that, again, it's the role of women, isn't it?
Yeah.
You're
obviously a feminist, but have you become one from writing books, researching? You know what I mean? Has it developed or was it always in there?
I've always been a feminist because I've always believed that women are more interesting than men intrinsically. I feel that women are more intelligent. I think they're kinder. They tend to be more fun. I mean, I had a best woman at my wedding, for instance.
Yes!
Because I feel that men are just essentially redundant. And I feel that as the 21st century rolls on, the balance of the sexes will be redressed. And I hope my daughter goes and, you know, leapfrogs over any of her male contemporaries. And I'm sure she will.
Your daughter's 9 and a half months old. What's she called?
Rose Evelyn Bowie Larman.
Thank you so much for coming on to Radio Gorgeous. Byron's Women is published by Head of Zeus. And you've just got to quickly tell me what you're working on at the moment, because I know I've given you lots of ideas, but...
Book four is going to be very interesting, probably about a major 20th century literary figure, but I can't say more than that at the moment.
Okay, thank you so much for coming on to Radio
pleasure.
Gorgeous.
This is a Radio Gorgeous production for Radio Gorgeous 2016. For more information, go to radiogorgeous.com.